This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rachel Coughlin, and I look after audience research and public programs here at the National Museum of Australia. Thank you for coming. This is a significant occasion. Dr. John Falk and Dr. Lynn Deerking are internationally recognised leaders in museum evaluation, visitor research and learning theory. They have been instrumental to the significant progress over the last 10 years in our understanding of museum learning, helping us to make informed decisions about how to create the best possible exhibitions and programs for our audiences. They have helped us to think deeply about the meaning and purpose of museums, and we are privileged to have them here with us today. John and Lynn are particularly good at building a bridge between theory and practice, and I know many of you will have questions for them. Just as we know that museum visitors learn more and return more often when they are actively engaged, we will be inviting questions from you at the end of the presentation. You should also know that we're recording the presentations today for use on our website. Before we start, I'd like to thank the generous support of today's seminar by Museums Australia, the ACT branch, and the University of Canberra's Institute for Cultural Heritage, the Donald Horne Institute for Cultural Heritage. These partnerships are vital for the museum sector, and we are lucky to enjoy the support of our peers. But for now, I'd like you to join me in welcoming John and Lynn to the National Museum of Australia.
So can you hear me now? Okay. All right. So it's wonderful to be here. We feel privileged to be here. Thank you all for coming today on, I guess, relatively short notice. So that's good. So just to give you a brief overview of what we're going to do, both Lynn and I are going to talk for about half an hour each. We have two parts to what we're going to talk about. We're going to each talk about two different series of studies, just to give you a sense. Perhaps the misnomer was that it was implied that it was current research in free choice learning broadly defined. It's current research that we've been involved with, Truth in Advertising. So I'm going to talk about some of the research I've been doing on identity-related motivations, as well as a study that I've been doing more or less continuously for more than a dozen years at the California Science Center, trying to understand broadly the long-term impact of that institution on its community. Lynn is going to talk about some of the research she's been doing with girls in after-school programs and free choice learning experiences and looking long-term at those impacts, as well as a particular exhibition program and how that was integrated into families' lives. So with that, let me just ramble in. And I will say, if any of you are feeling like you desperately want to ask me a question or interrupt, feel free to do that. But once again, we're going to have time at the end to have questions. So, you know, it might be easier for me to see it from here. Okay. Historically, the way we have thought about the museum experience is, for good reasons, we have tended to compartmentalize that experience as something that happens from the moment somebody walks in the front door until the moment they leave. And we have, and this is the royal we, but actually as an industry, we've particularly over the last 15, 20 years, we've devoted considerable time and effort to try and make sense of what visitors, why visitors are coming, what they do within our institution, and what they take away with it. Historically, though, most of that research has been contained within, figuratively and literally, the four walls of the institution. I would argue that we actually cannot understand visitors and the experiences they have if all we do is look at and talk to people as they're inside the institution. The visitor experience starts long before they arrive. Obviously, things happen inside the box, but much of what ultimately ends up and sticks in their head are caused by events that happen after they leave. And so if we actually talk to people, as I've done, and others, as they're leaving the institution and trying to understand what the meaning of this experience was in their lives, it's not that they won't tell you something. It's that they can't actually tell you anything that's really useful to you because they don't know. It's not that they're trying to hide things from you. But the real value and purpose of that experience often isn't revealed to them until days, weeks, months, and sometimes years later. So if we really want to make sense of the museum experience, we need to begin to pan the camera back in time and space, as it were, and look more broadly at that experience and how these institutions intersect with people's lives. And it begins, as it turns out, with their expectations and motivations. Now, we've always assumed, or many of us have always assumed, that people come to museums, they come with prior experiences, they come with prior knowledge, they have expectations and motivations for being there, and those obviously shape that experience. The way we have attempted to try and understand our institutions often is by looking at the concrete aspects of our museums or our visitors. So we segment visitors more traditionally into demographic categories, call them, you know, their family groups and their adults and their children. We talk about them as frequent visitors or infrequent visitors. We talk about our museums in terms of their collections, you know, their art museums or their history museums or their interactive museums, and all those kinds of characterizations, which by and large is a valiant attempt to make this a concrete experience so that once and for all we can characterize the museum and once and for all we can characterize the visitor. What my research is beginning to show is that that's not a very reasonable way and ultimately not even a very useful way to make sense of this. That literally we need to view, as challenging as it is, and each time an individual interacts with the museum, it's a unique experience, and it is an ephemeral experience that is defined by that person and their needs and their interests on that day, in that place, in that time. And tomorrow, the same person can go and have an entirely different experience in the same place because they're a different person and have different needs. So we can't segment visitors based on gender, age, race, ethnicity, whether they're there as a family group or anything like that. That ultimately doesn't buy us much. At least that's my contention. So why do people visit museums? Well, obviously, the short answer is for many, many different reasons. In fact, based on what I just said, there is many different reasons as there are people who visit museums. That said, as I have talked to now thousands of visitors, both before they come, as well as weeks, months, and in some cases years later, trying to understand and unpack the motivations for the reasons people come to museums, they tend to come for five basic reasons. Now, as I say, there are thousands of reasons people give, but these can be organized into five big categories. And I'm going to put a big asterisk there, and I'm going to come back and talk about this classification scheme in a minute. But for the sake of argument, I have colorfully described these five groups as explorers, facilitators, experience seekers, professional hobbyists, and rechargers. And real quickly, just to give you a sense of this cast of characters, and they aren't really cast of characters, it's a cast of motivations. And they really represent people's leisure-related identity needs that they're trying to exercise at that institution. Explorers are people who say, who believe that they're there because they're curious people and they're looking to find new and interesting things to discover. If you ask them, what is it you're trying to find out here? They say, well, I don't know. I'll know it when I see it. And they do. They find it. And what they find something that's interesting to them, they glom onto that and spend a lot of time and are very curious about it. They're the kind of people who say, I go to an art museum because I like art. I go to history museums because I like history. I go to science museums because I like science. So what science are you trying to learn? Once again, it's not that I'm trying to learn any science. I like science, and I'm sure there'll be something here that'll interest me. There's a whole group of people that we're familiar with called facilitators. And actually, the reason they're there is for somebody else. Often they're parents, and they're there to support and facilitate the experience of their children. But they could also be adults there bringing other adults. Aunt Martha is visiting from out of town. I know she likes this kind of place, so I'm going to bring Aunt Martha here, and she'll have a grand old time. What do you expect to get out of it? I expect that Aunt Martha will have a grand old time. Did you expect to learn anything? I expect to learn that Aunt Martha had a grand old time. That's why I'm here. There are people called experience seekers, and actually the interesting thing is, I confess that I began this research with the assumption that these were fairly common. I've discovered that they're actually relatively uncommon, but these are the people we often think of as tourists. You know, I'm here in Canberra, what do? Well, you should go see the National Museum. Okay, I'll go see the National Museum. Then I can say I've been there and done that. And when I go home, I can tell people, yeah, I went to the National Museum, therefore I did Canberra. I can put a notch on my belt and say I've been there, done that. But they, by and large, are motivated by the experience to be there, to see that place, because it is an iconic place within their community. And there are people who bring out-of-town visitors to these places for the same reason, because they feel an identity with this as their part of their community. This is obviously more common for large, iconic institutions. It is less common for small institutions for these kinds of visitors to be there. There are a group, they're not huge, but they're important, called professional hobbyists. These are the people who show up in order to facilitate and to specifically find out new information about some aspect of, that they are very deeply interested in. I like to give the example that once upon a time, not lately, Lynn and I used to be divers. We're still divers, but we haven't dived for a while. But before I would go diving in a tropical reef, since I don't live in a tropical environment, I would make it a point to go to my local aquarium and literally use that as an experience to recall and, you know, freshen up my knowledge of tropical fish identification, because it was a lot easier to practice tropical fish identification when they're sitting there swimming in the tank than when you're down under the water 50 meters or whatever, and, you know, things are darting by. So in that case, I was a professional hobbyist when I went to that aquarium. And then finally, there are a surprisingly large number of people who go to museums for what I'm calling this sort of rejuvenation, refreshment, recharger experience, where literally it's to get away from it all. Surprisingly enough, there aren't that many people who go to interactive science centers with this motivation, but there are a lot of people who go to art museums or aquariums, national parks, and those kinds of places that fit that model. So this is just one example, and I put it up here to sort of make the point. Now, obviously, the profile for any different institution is going to vary seasonally, and it's going to vary between institutions. But this is actually from some of the data I'm going to talk about later. This is from a telephone survey of Greater Los Angeles, where I was talking to people who had visited the California Science Center sometime in the last 5 years and asking them to talk about the reasons they went. Now, what is interesting is the public didn't have any problem segmenting the reasons they visited across these five dimensions. 90% of them could fit into one of these categories. Part of the reason for throwing this slide up, though, is to make a point. And that point is that despite the fact that you see this distribution, you know, obviously the largest percentage here are facilitators, but almost an equal number of explorers. And there are a healthy, although not significant, you know, in the grand scheme of things, there are a bunch of professional hobbyists, rechargers, experience seekers. 95% of all the people who visit the California Science Center come with children. Technically, every visitor to the California Science Center is a family visitor. But that doesn't necessarily, the fact that they showed up with children doesn't mean that they're facilitators. And this is really an important point. There are an awful lot of people who use their kids as a ticket to go. I mean, we have typically the way we have segmented audiences is, and I hate to say this if there are any marketing people in the crowd, it's really been marketing-driven research. And by and large, there's been a tendency to believe what people say superficially. So that if I ask people, why did you come to the museum today? People give a range of answers. If they're there with children, they're inclined to say, I'm here because of my children. Some people say, I'm here to learn. Some people give lots of different reasons. But if we really want to understand what motivates people, we can't just superficially ask them why you're here. You have to go deeper than that. And this research that I'm talking about is based on much deeper and much, what I would like to believe, more serious implications in terms of the true motivations people have for their visit. Again, by analogy, if you walked into a restaurant and did an interview of all the people sitting in that restaurant and asked them, why are you here today? How many of the people sitting in that restaurant would volunteer that the reason they're there today is because they're hungry? Not many. They would give you reasons like, I like the food, it's convenient, I like the view, I like the wait staff, whatever. It would be assumed, implied, that they're hungry. That's why they're at a restaurant. In a very analogous way, virtually all these people are here to learn something. Some overtly, some not so overtly. Some learning light, and some learning deep. But learning is implicit in their reason for showing up. And so, once again, none of my categories distinguish between, educational learning and non-learning types, because everybody is there for one reason or another for that purpose. But these explanations, as it turns out, turn out to help provide meaningful ways to segment visitors at all kinds of museums. And to date, now most of the data has been collected in the U.S., but there's been comparable data collected in the U.K. There's comparable data that's been collected here in Australia. There is comparable data that we've collected in Medellin, Colombia, which is a useful outlier point. It's not your typical Western middle-class kind of audience. And these categories seem to work across a wide range of institutions. Perhaps more importantly, is that not only can you segment audiences this way, you can segment audiences anyway. You can segment them demographically. You could segment the audience in this auditorium on the color of the clothes that they're wearing. We can do that statistically. Whether that predicts anything or provides anything useful is a whole other question. What is interesting, though, is that this way of segmenting audiences actually tells you something about how they'll actually behave in the museum, and actually does a reasonable job of qualitatively predicting the kinds of memories and experiences that they'll have. That people with comparable kinds of identity-related visit motivations use the experience in comparable ways and make sense of the experience in comparable ways. So that, for example, this is data from that I collected from zoos and aquariums. So two visitors, both of whom stopped in front of at a gorilla exhibit. And when we talked to them 3 months later, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is the gist of it. So tell me about your experience. Visitor one, it was a great gorilla day for Billy. Billy just loves gorillas, and it was so much fun to see Billy looking at those gorillas. He had a great time. Visitor two, well, I should say, and what about you? I really enjoyed seeing Billy enjoy the gorillas. Did you look at the gorillas? Sure, I looked at the gorillas, but Billy was so fascinated by the gorillas. Visitor two, so tell me about your experience. It says, you can't believe I got to look eye to eye with this gorilla. It was amazing, the look in the face of that gorilla. And what about George? You were with George. Oh, George had a great time, but I could look face to face with this gorilla. So, two family visitors, but how they made sense of that experience was qualitatively different based on whether, in the first case, they were a facilitator, and in the second case, they were an explorer. More to the point, again, this is data from research from the California Science Center. If we look, and this is very specific, this is looking at a very narrow slice of learning. This is literally an exhibit on human biology and trying to understand and measure how much human biology did these folks learn. So this is as they walked into this permanent exhibit. I guess I have a pointer. I have technology. So this is as they walked into the exhibit. This is as they were walking out of the exhibit. Explorers, facilitators, no big difference, right? This is actually 2 years later. And you can't, this person basically went back, this group basically went back to baseline, although arguably, probably with this sample size, this is probably not significant, but if I had a larger sample size, that might be significant. But clearly, this difference is significant. And so, depending on what their reasons were, these people were there to learn for themselves. And what they learned stuck. whereas this group was there to facilitate the learning of others. And although in the short term, the ideas were there, but since that was not the purpose of their visit, they forgot about that stuff. That wasn't ultimately important to them. And there was nothing that they could do to reinforce it. How did I get there? Okay, I see what this is. So moving right along, turns out that this model is not only useful for predicting what why people come and what they do, it also provides insights into looking at why people don't come to museums. Now, historically, we have come up with lots of explanations for why people don't come to museums. And I will tell you most of the explanations, some of which I've spun, have to do with traditional notions of comfort and race and ethnicity and all that good stuff. But here's a simplified way of saying it. People come to museums because they believe that these are places that will satisfy specific leisure needs. And those specific leisure needs, as it turns out, have to do with those five reasons that I gave. Now, it's not because these are the only things that museums can support. It's because, as a society, by and large, we've defined culturally, socioculturally, we have said museums are good for these things. And so people perceive that, you know, if I have one of these needs, I can go to a museum. Why do people not go? Because they don't perceive that either A, museums can, in fact, support that. They have no reason to believe that they've ever had any experience that would suggest it's a good place to go to facilitate their family experiences, or that they're not good places for satisfying their own curiosity. Or for some reason, they're not even aware that there is such a place called a museum that could support those things. The wonder of these five categories is these are not unique to museum goers. We all, as humans, are curious. We all, as humans, have hobbies and interests. We all, as humans, have families and other people that we're trying to support and facilitate. We all try and do different things in our lives to have new experiences. We're all looking for ways to get away from the hassles of the daily world. But there's only a subset of people who think of museums as places specifically that will help them satisfy those needs. So the moral of the story is if we want to increase the number of people who think that museums are good places to go, the question is, how do you get more people to think of these institutions as places that could satisfy those needs? And then the hard job is when they get there, how do you ensure that that actually happens for them? Okay, so I'm going to switch gears real quickly and go on to a blank screen. Okay, that was my problem. That's because I got clever and used animation in my PowerPoint. So I'm going to talk about this study that I began in 1996 and have been intermittently conducting for the last 12 years. The research questions, there were a bunch of research questions, but the big ones I'm going to focus on at the moment is, does the California Science Center facilitate short and long-term science learning? And if so, what is the nature of this learning? And how successful has the California Science Center been in accomplishing its mission to enhance the science and technology understanding of Greater Los Angeles? You know, those are the kind of basic goals that most institutions have. You just remove the word science and fill in the blank, whatever kind of institution you have. Now, as I tried to conceptualize this study 15 years ago, there was good news and bad news. The good news is I actually, to pat myself on the back, had some useful insights in how I was going to go about achieving this very daunting task. The bad news was, of course, I didn't have infinite insight, and there were a lot of things that I should have done and should have thought about 15 years ago when I started organizing the study that I didn't think about. And today, as I look back and said, God, I wish I would have done this and I wish I would have done that, but I didn't, so there you have it. Basically, the grand scheme of the study, and I really did envision this as a decade-long study which was going to be supported in grand style by this institution, which it wasn't, and ultimately, actually, institution-supported funding ran out after a year and a half, and so I will say that virtually all the other studies that have been done subsequently have come from various grants that I, and in some cases the institution, have gotten, but we have used for this purpose. But it was conceptualized as a series of integrated studies where there would be some studies where literally we, what I mean by inside out, is we would talk to people in the institution and try and follow them, understand what they did there, and as I say, literally track them over time to try and see if we can figure out what that impact is. The outside in studies, which is the opposite. Let's talk to a lot of people outside in the community and see if we can have a vision for what this institution looks like as we try and situate it in the lives of people as we talk to them outside in the community. Needless to say, in the next 10 minutes, 5 minutes, I'm not going to give you all the details of the study, but just some quick things. Some really important statistics. First of all, and I've just been told that my numbers are wrong by people at the California Science Center when I sent them this, they currently, their story is they get 1.4 million visitors a year. They come from all over Greater Los Angeles, and I've been told that if you count Greater Los Angeles, it's 15 million people, not 10 million people. But as of 2009, and literally we just collected, we collected a series of citywide random telephone surveys, you know, the obnoxious people who call you at 7 o'clock and want you to talk to them. 1 year before the institution opened, the new California Science Center, and if you want to know the gory details, I'll put an asterisk on that one, too. 1 year after it opened, and then again 10 years after it opened. It opened its doors as a new institution in 1998, December of 1998. But in this most recent survey, 41% of the adults in Los Angeles said they had been to the California Science Center within the last 5 years. That's a staggering number. And they claimed that on average they'd been there 3 times in the last 5 years. That is an amazing penetration in a large community. 12% indicated they'd been there in the last year. And again, we might think this 41% number is dubious, but we, you know, within the realm that people might lie, you know, at least they were going to likely remember what they did in the last 12 months. And so even if there's we can assume that maybe there's some inflation there, even if only 8% of LA, so even if it was 50% inflated, if 8% of Greater Los Angeles went to the California Science Center within the last year, that's an amazing statistic in and of itself in terms of the impact that institution is having on its community. Well, that's great. That's just sort of that gross number. But what about in terms of actually supporting public understanding of science? So we were earlier in the study, before we talked about the California Science Center, we asked people to self-report basically how informed do you feel you are about science? And what is the evidence that you are informed about science? And for that, and you see that I neglected to include that baseline study, and that's part of the asterisk. It gets ugly. But the asterisk, briefly, is that the predecessor institution to the new California Science Center had been around in L.A. since 1912. And so there was, when we talked, and we used the old name, and so, you know, it had been around in California, in L.A., Southern California, forever. So in a sense, whereas I thought I was being clever and had really baseline information, in fact, I had no baseline information. So the baseline is from after being open 1 year versus being open for a decade. But you can still see the same basic trends, that the people who are most informed are likely to be have gone to the California Science Center, and you can see that there's a significant increase over a 10-year period in that data. Again, this is evidence that this institution is making an impact on its community. Real quickly, you know, I generated a list of 18 different outcomes that were possible learning kinds of outcomes that visitors could have. And they're arrayed there, and I'm not going to read them to you, but you can read them. But what you can see is they range from up the top. The visit reminded me of several things about science and technology I had forgotten. And at the bottom is I learned at least one thing that I did not know. And in between are behavior changes. Actually, that's what's interesting is that's the second most common cited thing is that literally people are saying their behavior changed, which is amazing, as opposed to attitude change. The wonderful thing about that top one is people have long postulated, including us, that really what people learn in museums is what they sort of already know. In other words, it's not that people come in tabula rasa, don't know anything, and now they walk out knowing something. And it's not even that they come in and by and large are using this as a classroom to become schooled in some topic. But that what literally they come away knowing is more about stuff that they sort of already knew. And the final thing I was going to talk about is how do you actually measure something like that? Because there's always an attribution issue. How would you really know that what somebody learned is that something somebody learned, that they actually learned it there as opposed to someplace else? So I was clever enough to come up with this idea of creating essentially the equivalent of a radioactive tracer, which if you know anything about biology, a tracer gets, you know, like a radioactive isotope gets put into the body. It doesn't affect the body, but you can see things going on in the body that you couldn't normally see. So I tried to come up with something that was the equivalent of a radioactive tracer. That's an iconic exhibit that was created at the California Science Center. It goes by the name of Tess. It's a 50-foot animatronic lady who gives this whole spiel. And because, God bless him, the curator of this exhibit was a human physiologist, he decided what the world really needed to know about was homeostasis. Now, homeostasis is a topic that is taught in high school biology, and virtually everybody learns it in high school biology, but nobody really knows it. So, quick show of hands. How many people in this audience could confidently give me a definition of homeostasis? Raise your hand. Not very many. Okay. So unfortunately, I didn't have a baseline before in that early, you know, that original data that I collected in 1998 before the institution opened. But I did collect data as people walked in the front door of the California Science Center. I also looked to try and figure out how many people actually go to this exhibit. Well, it turns out that if 80% of the people see that exhibit and 80% are able to actually correctly define that so 80% of the people who visit the Science Center go to that exhibit, and 80% of those people as they walk out the door can actually define homeostasis. But in 1998, only 7% of the people who walked into the California Science Center, which was a self-selected population, could define homeostasis. So even the visitors to the California Science Center, the baseline is only 7%. And if I collected this data, had the wisdom to collect it before the Science Center opened, I'm going to guess that that number was about 4 or 5%. It's still a significant change. In 1 year, the number went up to 10%. Who could define homeostasis? That's significant. By 2009, 19% of the population of Los Angeles could define homeostasis. There's no reason. There's been no big push in the public media for the world to know homeostasis. But what is so fascinating is when you ask people where they learned it, 64% of people say they learned it in school, which at some level is true, right? 10% attribute the California Science Center. But there's a significant correlation between those who can define it and those who've been to the California Science Center, and a significant correlation between even those who've heard of it, the word, let alone be able to define it. So attribution in terms is always an issue because we don't learn anything in one place at one time. But we now have some data that would suggest that, yes, we can see. Is it important whether homeostasis was learned or not? That's not important. What the evidence shows that when I can show that there's been a relationship between learning and science in general and this institution, and that learning specifically any particular idea and this institution, then we can say without a doubt this is an institution that is having an impact on its community. Take it away.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be here in Canberra again Actually, we were realizing this is our third visit, but it's been a long time in between the second and third visit. But it's wonderful to be back here. Our friends in Brizzy warned us that it was going to be very cold here, but I just want you to know that we were feeling quite comfortable. And, you know, winter in Canberra is nothing like winter in Oregon, and certainly nothing like winter on the east coast of the U.S. where we used to live. But at any rate, it's a delight to be here. I'm going to talk about two projects, as John did, and interestingly, they are also looking sort of long-term at experiences, but because of the nature of the projects, they're quite different in terms of how we're looking at them. Both of them, and this is really important, are retrospective studies where we're talking to people after the experience and talking to them about their perceptions of the long-term impacts. The first project is a family-based project, and let me tell you a little bit about it. This project was all about, it took place at the Children's Museum in Indianapolis, Indiana, in the U.S. This museum, back in 2001, decided that despite the fact that they were a children's museum, they wanted to redefine themselves as focusing on family learning. And I can tell you more about that in a moment. The bottom line is they thought that this, and we did too, thought that this was a simple thing to do, but actually we discovered that it was far more involved than we thought. Interestingly, unlike many children's museums, this children's museum has a collection, and because of the fascination and relationship that the director had to China, it also has the largest display of juvenile and actually family dinosaur fossils in the U.S. They actually own one of the few dinosaur eggs where you can actually see the embryo inside. They have a teenage dinosaur, and they actually have mother dinosaurs along with baby dinosaurs, which if you think about it, if you're trying to become a family learning-based children's museum, it's wonderful that you have a family of dinosaurs. The idea around this exhibition was they wanted to immerse people in the sights and smells and feelings of what it was like in the Cretaceous period. And a little thing that you should know about me is I love dinosaurs. I don't know how I became so interested in them because I saw my first real dinosaur skeleton when I was about 25, but I was always fascinated by them. I always loved fossils. And one of the dreams that I'd always had is that wouldn't it be cool if I could like fly over a moment in the Cretaceous, and I could hear and see and sort of experience what it was like safely above, certainly Tyrannosaurus Rex. But I'll tell you, this exhibit gets pretty close. And so what the exhibit did is create these diorama spaces. And actually, every 30 minutes, it goes through a day cycle. And so, and there's lightning, there's a lightning storm, a thunderstorm, which thinking about young children, there were some issues related to that. But there's this real rich immersive experience. And then around these dioramas, there are a variety of more in-depth interactive experiences. There's a dig site where you can actually dig for dinosaurs. There are all sorts of interactive stations. Some of those are the typical maybe sitting down and doing something on a computer. There's a great experience where you get to design a dinosaur and make different choices, and then you get to figure out if your dinosaur would actually survive or not. And the space, because this was about families, the space where this is doesn't just have one chair and doesn't just speak to, you know, one person being there, but it was set up so that there's this very comfy sort of curving chair that invites more than one person to be a part of that experience. Some of those interactive stations are puzzles where you sit down at a table and so forth. And there's also first-person interpretation. There's a paleontologist that comes through on occasion that'll take you sort of on that kind of experience. And there's also a place where you can go in and actually talk to a curator about how they actually find the dinosaurs and so forth. Along with the exhibition, though, there was a real effort to create programming as well. And in fact, to mix up the notion of where the exhibit started and where programming ended. So there was a lot of, as I said, first-person interpretation in the exhibit itself, but there were classes for children. There were, which I never got to do, but I really wanted to, there were camp-ins where you got to sleep with the dinosaurs. And there were some day trips where you actually, they took people out in nearby places to look at sites. And they even did some summer trips where you could go out west and actually dig dinosaurs. And really important, this was the first exhibition after that strategic plan to focus on families, where very purposefully from the very beginning, we, and I say we because actually myself and a couple of other people, this study was done when I was still at the Institute for Learning Innovation, we actually were members of the team. So we actually played the role of both researchers, but also we were a part of the team and helped think about how that information could be used. I probably should share with you the way we were conceiving of family learning. And our notion of this was that it was a special kind of free choice learning and related to both the way that families interact, talk together, and share experiences. And it's also about taking something away that one can tangibly say, you know, I learned this in this museum. And because families are very social, it was also about this notion of reinforcing family identity and history. This is guided very much by families' needs and interests. And actually, John and I haven't had the opportunity, but we've been talking about his categories for motivational needs are very focused on individuals, trying to look at those needs across social groups and seeing how those needs get negotiated. So I'm sure that embedded in those needs and interests are many of the categories that he found. And basically, what family learning is all about is learning that families do together when they're interested in something, curious about something, and they do it across the lifespan of the family. So the research questions that we had is that we were now going to go back a couple of years after this exhibition had opened and say, you know, how was this exhibit? Its interpretive programs that I described, and the additional in-depth experiences integrated into the lives of families. Was there any evidence that there were any impacts? And also, we were very curious if visitors had noticed. We've had several conversations today at the museum, and I'm sure in your own institutions, if you're not from here, you know, you make these decisions to change as an organization, to change your focus, or to maybe reinvent yourself. And the question that the Children's Museum had is, did anyone notice? You know, did those families notice that this was a different place than it had been? That we've tried to make this change in terms of not being so focused on children alone. The approach that we took was to do in-depth semi-structured phone interviews. And these were 15 to 20 minutes long. And the sample included families who'd participated in an in-depth assessment that we had actually done of this exhibition about a year after it opened. And these were people who we actually asked them at the time, would you be willing to be recontacted? And so we had contact information for them. And then we also were able to include in the sample families who'd actually participated in some of those in-depth experiences. So we have a mix of people, and those groups weren't necessarily totally independent of one another. There were people who'd visited the exhibit that had participated in an in-depth program. Certainly most of the people who'd participated in an in-depth program had been to the exhibition. And by the way, the other important thing to know, and I understand that's the case actually for this institution also, there's a very high number of people in Indianapolis that are return visitors and use the Children's Museum very, very frequently. I think 45% of their audience are return visitors. The sample size, we talked to adults, so the sample size was 48 adults, but that the total, if you counted all of the family members, was 144. And these were people who had visited the exhibition and or participated in one or more of the programs 3 months to a year before. So what did we find out? Well, first of all, and this is sort of, I think, a message that John was communicating, but I'll reinforce it again, is that, you know, we tend to think about what do people take away from the experience and what have we done for them versus thinking that people come to our institutions and they use us to accomplish the things that they want to accomplish. And so one of the things that was really, really interesting was totally unprompted, people talked about the use of this exhibition as a family resource. Something that was great, they talked about it was a wonderful place for them to interact with their children. It was a wonderful place. Some of the adults talked about that facilitator role, you know, Johnny or Sally loves dinosaurs, and you know, I wanted to take them there. But there were also a large number of adults that said, and you know what I really liked about that exhibit was that I could learn as well. Something I didn't share with you, the whole design had sort of invited both collaborative learning but also single adult learning. One of my favorite parts of the exhibit, and this is where I could kind of get the feeling like I was in the Cretaceous, was there were tunnels you could crawl underneath and come up in, and you were in the middle of the diorama. Those tunnels were made wide enough that an adult and a kid could crawl together. Or, as I discovered, yeah, even in Indiana, doll. Yeah, that might be pushing. And I can attest it was also inviting enough that an adult by herself, you know, could sort of crawl in and have that experience. Actually, another place, they used the, you know, the old-fashioned viewers. They had viewers set up so that you could look more closely at the dinosaurs in the dioramas. And there were viewers that were adult height, and there were viewers that were kid height. And they were close together so that actually adults and kids could look at the same thing together and talk about what they were seeing. So there was a real effort to encourage collaboration. The other place that was great was there was an area where you could actually get in the nest of a dinosaur, remember that family theme, and where you could dress up either as a paleontologist or as a dinosaur complete with tail. And they made, though, they had two sizes. So you could be an adult and you could dress up like a dinosaur. I won't tell you who did that. And then you could also dress up like a paleontologist. And a kid could be a paleontologist. There was a lot of choice and opportunity. People talked a lot about And we had also observed in the in-depth study a lot of exhibit-focused conversation, a lot of, you know, families reading, describing, talking, questioning, and a lot of connecting the experience to life. There was just some great examples where we used, for example, children's hands and adults' hands, and then, you know, a dinosaur footprint for Bucky, the teenage juvenile, and an adult dinosaur. You know, ways for people to be thinking about those differences in size. People talked about really, really enjoying the exhibition and feeling like it contributed to the family either learning something new or, as John was saying, reinforcing something that they'd already seen. Once again, and in part this was just because they had this wonderful opportunity because they had juvenile dinosaurs. There are a lot of adults who said, you know, I mean, I guess I always thought there were young dinosaurs and baby dinosaurs. They had to come from somewhere. But actually seeing a tangible skeleton brought that to life even more. You know, people said, you know, we read the Mayasaur book and we knew that there were eggs and stuff, but then all of a sudden there's adults. They loved seeing the progression. So a quarter of the adults felt that the child family increased or reinforced their knowledge. And they talked a great deal, and I think this is important as we think about experiences we provide. They talked a lot about staff or the person who came along. And so we were talking about Aunt Martha or whoever she was. But, you know, that often brought a memorability to the moment. It helped people remember they were... That made it a special sort of event. And they talked a lot about staff, you know, interactions with staff. You know, it was a great facilitator. The person who was in the curator lab really helped me think about how you dig out a dinosaur. So that piece was very important. What was really interesting is that a lot of adults talked about the sense that family learning was a part of the experience. But I want to make a caveat that they didn't tend to use that term. They talked about, you know, being together. They sometimes talked about learning together, but the notion of family learning wasn't necessarily one of the ways they talked about it. They talked a lot, and of course we were encouraging this because we were talking to them much later. They talked a lot about the extension of the experience, and they talked about conversations that they had later, other things that they had done, the fact that they went back to the exhibit several times, and they also talked about the fact that they shared the experience with people who had not been there. All of these are things that we have an idea are a part of the experience, but this really helped us to see that that was definitely the case. As I said, families did not use the term family learning without prompting, but they talked about interactivity. They actually used the word hands-on, which, just another little aside, over the years since John and I started doing research, you know, that wasn't a term that people really had in their vernacular, but it's very much a term that people understand. They talked a lot about appealing to learners of all ages. You know, this there was something I could do here. And they talked a lot, once again, about that adult learning. Little caveat to that, there are several children's museums that are realizing that, you know, the decision maker for most visits to children's museums are adults, and that actually they do need to be thinking more about how they can appeal to those adults. Because if you're an adult and you're thinking about taking your child to a museum, you might think sometimes, well, you know, I'll go to the children's museum and that'll be great for them. But You know, if you're not a facilitator or if you're not feeling particularly generous that that weekend, they're realizing we need to offer something to the adults, so they'll want to come because of their own learning as well as their kids' learning. They talked a lot about both the pre-visit and the post-visit experiences. Actually, I didn't mention there was a website where you could do some planning for your visit before you arrived, and that seemed really important. And the bottom line is that they really felt that the interpretation and programming that was a part of the exhibit really contributed to them better understanding something about dinosaurs, but also having an enjoyable quality family experience. And I think that's really what's important as we think about, you know, these experiences. So I'm going to switch to my other study. I'll let the professional do it. I'm just about out of time. I will do a very quick overview. This is changing perspective quite a bit. This is a study about young women who've participated in either after school, sometimes museum-based experiences, and our effort, myself and a colleague at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, we have a National Science Foundation grant from U.S. National Science Foundation to try to track down these young women who participated in programs at least 5 to 10 years ago to see if there's any evidence, again, that this has had an influence on them. And something that I'm really excited about is that we're actually looking both at the impact in terms of education and careers, what I call the usual suspects, but we're also looking at hobbies and habits of mind. Because we're looking so long-term, we can even, some of these young women are parents, and we can even talk to them about whether this experience had any influence on them thinking about their parenting and the importance of science. So the question that we're asking is, you know, what role do these free choice experiences play in girls' interest, engagement, and participation in science communities, hobbies, and careers? And sub-questions are, we're really interested in how much these young women have taken science in as part of the way they think about themselves and identify themselves. And we're talking not so much about sort of science content, but would this person think of themselves as a science-interested, science-engaged person? And then the other question that we're really interested in is what role do the significant adults who are part of this program play? And also, in a few cases, parents were involved with the program. Did they play a role at all in the impacts that we see? We're using a community of practice framework, and for those of you who maybe are not familiar with that, it's really this notion that identity and community are very much connected, and that that an individual changes, learns, evolves by participating in community, and that ideally the community changes as a result of the participation of the individual. And there's three elements that are really critical when you're thinking about community of practice. There's generally a domain of knowledge that you're interested in. And in our case, we have focused in on science, and I would say technology, engineering, and mathematics, broadly defined. You also, of course, are really concerned about the community of people who care about and are engaged in the domain. And then there's the shared practices that you develop and feel make you a part of this community. Now, that sounds all very abstract, but for those of you who design programs, you know, you're thinking about, well, what am I going to have people do? What kind of feeling do I want people to have being a part of this program? And then what are the, you know, these shared practices that they're going to engage in around whatever the topic of the program is? So that's really the essence of community of practice. Where we've used it in trying to understand the impact on these young women is trying to see about, look at the domain of science in particular to see if we can see impacts there. Look at the community that was created both at the moment of the program, but also the community that these young women are now engaged in, if they are. And then also whether they left with any sense of the practice of, in this case, being a scientist, and whether they continue to engage in that practice now. Very quickly, we are recruiting young women through five programs that were national in focus, that actually have been evaluated and have been in place for at least 15 to 20 years. So we wanted to find stable programs. We wanted to find programs where we knew they were very, very successful. What we are trying to do initially is just show what impacts we might see under the best of circumstances. This is not a definitive study. It really is a best case scenario. And we're just trying to get a sense of, in the best programs with the most engaged young women, do we see any impacts? Because if we don't see impacts at that stage, then, you know, doing this larger national study is going to be tough. These programs, which don't have a lot of meaning here, but just to give you a sense, were selected because they either deal with girls at different ages, or a couple of the programs involve families. One of the programs had a research experience that young women participated in. One was focused on identifying a community problem and working on a focus. So the thought is that we will also, there were very different communities of practice created, and so that we can actually tease out and look at the influence of those communities of practice. There are five research phases, and we are just in the middle of investigation two. So that's why it's preliminary results. But we started out the study by really talking to some young women about science and about their lives so we could hear the way they talk about it. We used those findings to develop a web-based survey, and which we are now administering to a selection of women who participated in each of these programs. In the next phase, we are going to actually do life history, life story interviews, and actually potentially visit some of the communities. Part of this investigation, because we're using community of practice and a more qualitative approach, one part of the study is to have young women look at our results, young women who weren't in the study, and give us a sense of whether they feel that the ideas, interpretations that we've made are valid. And so that it's called this member check in the world of community of practice. We've decided to do one other member check, which is we are going to find some women who are engaged in science out in their grown-up lives, who had nothing to do with any of these programs. People who are scientists, maybe someone who's the president of their local astronomy club. So it's more of an avocation, but they're very science engaged. Different folks, and we're going to have them look at the findings and tell us whether there is credence to the fact that maybe they had an experience like this. So we're trying, even though it's a qualitative study, we're trying to do some checking. And then based on those checking experiences, we're going to create some case studies of the way these programs have influenced young women. I'm going to go through that really quick. Let me just tell you very quickly about What we've done in the first phase to create the web-based survey, we actually used a data collecting technique that John and colleagues at the Institute created called personal meaning mapping. And that's how we did those initial interviews to hear young women talk about their experiences. And we used this approach and did it in two phases where we sat down with young women, and the first thing we did was we gave them a piece of paper that had me in the middle of it. And we asked them to write, draw, do anything on that paper that would help describe them. We were a little uneasy about this at first. We weren't quite sure whether this was going to, resonate very well. We forgot that a lot of these women they've been about 18 to 26, 27 at this point. They love, once they realize, you mean you really want me to write down about me? They love it. And so, and we've had a range. One young woman drew a picture of mashed potatoes. And actually, that same young woman had just gotten engaged, so she drew a picture of an engagement ring. They're writing down lots of stuff about themselves. We interview them after they've made that map and just talk to them a little bit about me and do a little bit of probing. And then we move that paper aside and we give them another piece of paper that has the program that they participated in the middle. And we ask them to do the same thing. Write down all the things that you think about. And then we talk to them about that. And then we put the maps together because if we're interested in me and identity and this science impacts, trying to see what the relationship between the two maps are. So we ended up talking to women between 20 to 29, 10 to 15 years prior. They had the experience 10 to 15 years prior. And what we found, first of all, was that this technique was a great way to talk to them about the role of science in their lives without directly saying, can you tell me about the role of science in your life? Because, of course, they would have looked at us like we were, appropriately, they would have looked at us like we were crazy. They did not, in terms of the maps, particularly the map about the program, there wasn't a lot about science on it, but specific science content, but a lot about the processes they engaged in, and a lot of details about what they did. We went on, one of the programs was around Girl Scouting, and they took a this particular group went on a lot of outdoor field trips. Their scout leader loved geology, took a lot of trips, talked a lot about seeing rocks and geology. And in fact, by the way, said that later helped her with her, she was a history major in college, so she didn't pursue science. But she said, when I took the geology course that I had to take as one of my core courses, I could remember what those rocks look like, and that really helped me in this geology class. It made it real to me. What we've ended up doing in terms of these results is seeing that there are impacts that are very science-related, particularly to people who are now engaged in science, and also a series of outcomes that are more related to more general outcomes like interest. So real quickly, for women in science now, they talk about the fact that in some cases the program, depending on their age, helped develop an interest. For many of them, that it informed or reinforced an interest in science that they already had. Something that I think is going to be really important, and we're probing this in our further study, is they talked a lot about the community. They talked about both facilitators and adult leaders, but they talked about it was great to be with other girls who liked science. You know, along with this came this notion it was great to be with other girls and to be able to be smart. So there was some of that conversation going on. And interestingly, particularly some of these programs girls participated in at the high school age, they actually were using the program to see, you know, they thought they were interested in science, but they wanted to see, what are these scientists like? So one young woman talked about the fact that she had gone to a summer program at University of Washington, actually in Seattle, and her sole intent was to see whether the female scientists there had lives, because she wanted to have children, she likes to read, she thinks of herself, she actually, the second thing she wrote on her personal map is that I'm a well-rounded person. And by the way, she had just finished a doctorate in physics at University of Oregon. So, but it was really important. She says, I read, I garden, I sew. It was really important to her to have a life. And so she was using this program more as a way to see what is the community like that I might become a part of. However, what's really cool, I think, is that people who have not chosen, at least currently in their life trajectory, to go towards science, also talked about outcomes. They felt, and many of these programs, by the way, focused on, poor communities or, minorities communities where people aren't as often engaged in some of the, at least science. They talked about how much the program expanded their world and sense of self. There was one young woman who lives in Oakland, California, and she said, you know, I go hiking now. And she said, nobody in my neighborhood goes hiking. And so this sense of an expanded world. Once again, the young woman talked about it helping them with future science courses, help them develop interest and hobbies. A lot of people also talked about self-esteem and self-efficacy, and that the program helped them develop leadership skills. And interestingly, some of these programs had very purposeful ways that young women who started out maybe in middle school as a participant in the program, in high school became a facilitator of middle school kids. And so there was a purposeful effort to build in these leadership opportunities. And I think, this just tells you where we are. We're in the middle of, web-based survey. So I'm going to stop there, and then we can take some questions, which I guess we can. By the way, I just want to say that it is great to have comfy chairs up front that we can sit in. It is wonderful.
Yeah, I feel really privileged.
Yeah.
Hello. Hi, I'm Bobby Serini. I'm a PhD student at the Center for Public Awareness of Science at ANU. John, I had a question for you, which was about the values people have in relation to museums. You mentioned that visit decisions are actually driven by how people perceive the value of the museum. And I wondered if you'd done any research or you'd had a look at what the research is saying about where people develop those senses of values.
The short answer is I haven't done a lot. But I can give you, that never stopped me from giving an opinion. In a sense, what I'm hypothesizing at this point is that where did the people get the idea that I could go to this place and do this? In the sense, what I am suggesting that I believe, if I'm understanding your question correctly, and maybe I'm not, is that there is a perception that as I wake up on a Saturday morning and I'm trying to figure out what I want to do today, I run through a list of needs, and this isn't totally conscious, to be honest, but subconsciously I'm trying to figure out, so what should I do today? Okay, I got to go. Well, maybe today would be a good day to do something with the kids, okay? I haven't been a good parent lately. So what can I do with the kids? And then I'm running through a list of potential options of where I can be a good facilitator. And if, at least in the U.S., if I come, and this is where socioeconomics and history come in. If I come from a certain socioeconomic strata and I've had a certain personal history, in fact, the best predictor of what somebody does in their leisure time as an adult is what they did as a child in their leisure time. So if I came from a family that was inclined to think that this was an option, a museum is likely to pop up on my list of possible things I could do. And then I have to make a series of other cost-benefit decisions about whether that works. Now, how does that happen, that the public has those perceptions? I sort of envision this as a feedback loop. So after I've gone to the museum in order to take my kids there, I go home and I tell my friends and family, I had a great time. You know, they say, what did you do this weekend? I said, well, I went to the museum and had a great time with my kids. You know, by the way, it'd be a great place for you to take your kids, too. They'd have a wonderful time there. So in a sense, part of the outcome of a museum experience is it changes the person's own sense of identity. By and large, I have reinforced that I'm a good parent. But it also communicates out to the greater society that there are these places out there called museums that are good places where you can be a good parent. And that's just one example. So the public is basically, it's not as if the museum is necessarily advertising, you know, come here, be a good parent, though some do. But in society, we have a sense of what are these institutions and what do they afford. And some institutions communicate that they afford being good places to take kids, like children's museums and science centers. Art museums, by and large, are not perceived as great places for taking kids, but art museums are perceived as great places for doing other things. And that is somehow out there in the ether, there is this perception. What I haven't done is the research to really look at that more deeply.
My name's Mia Thornton. I'm a PhD candidate at ANU, and I also work here in the education section. I was just wondering if in your research, if you had any observations to make about the impact of digital media on people's motivations or experiences of museums, and if you think, in fact, that changes their motivations, particularly their off-site experiences. And I'm thinking about things like social media, Flickr, et cetera, if you had any comments to make about that.
Mm-hmm. You want to do that? Or?
Yeah, well, I can start there. A couple of things. One is I think that the whole social networking, social media world is still very unexplored and unused by many museums. In fact, there's a tremendous fear of them. And we've been visiting some institutions that, you know, they're afraid that, you know, they're going to be critiqued by the public and, you know, and it's going to be out there and the whole world's going to see it. Well, the truth is that the public can do that already. And it makes more sense maybe to try to think about how can you use these media to extend experiences, start experiences ahead of time, reach new audiences that perhaps are not using them. I would say that I think there's also a tendency to think about, oh, we need to have, you know, I was mentioning these interactives in exhibitions, actually pretty much across the board, even, by the way, talking to youth about it. They will talk about the fact that they sit at a computer all the time or they can do that at home. And so I think that what we really should be exploring in our institutions is how to use these tools as real tools for learning more or extending learning rather than as a product in and of itself. I think we've tended to, I think, you know, because we've been so focused sometimes just on the object or the experience, we've said, well, we'll just use that to show people the object or the experience, rather than saying, how can that be a tool to help someone better understand or connect to the objects? And then I think that social networking piece is very unexplored.
Yeah, the other comment I'll make, and this is probably not a big surprise, what little data there is would suggest that the majority of the public does use digital media in relationship to museums. Most people are still using it primarily to find out what the hours are, how to get directions there, to get a sense of what new exhibits might be there. The statistics that I'm aware of, despite the desire to drive people back to the web and other sources after a visit, are still pretty abysmal. Less than 10% of the public is following up experiences by going back to the web. That's a real challenge, and I think that, again, as I commented, that not only to make sense of these experiences do we need to pan the camera back in time and space to actually effectively make the most of what we have to offer. We have to somehow be a larger part of people's lives and not just the little slice that happens that 1 or 2 hours out of their lifetime that they happen to be in your institution. But that's figuring out how to crack that nut is still out there.
Hi, Graham Walker, also from the ANU. It's interesting to note that you saw changes in behaviour after the visit to the Science Centre. Did you get any data as to what kind of behaviours? And did you see any links from the kind of the motivation segments through to those different behaviours?
Well, the data that I showed is, of course, generic self-report data. I was as surprised as the next person to see how high that was. I mean, I literally, as I said, I created 18 different outcome statements, one of which, you know, what I did at the Science Center changed my behaviors relative to science or technology. Since this was a closed-ended survey, you know, that was the question, and they said yes or no, and there's the data. That it was really stunning that it was so high. Now, there have been other studies that we've done where we have literally tried to more directly track behavior change when that was considered to be a desired outcome of an experience, particularly a lot of the research done in zoos and aquariums where they have a very overt effort to want to change the public's environmental behaviors. Those results are less than encouraging, by and large, is that there's relatively little, the evidence is that relatively few people, if any, long-term are changing their behaviors based on what they do at a zoo or aquarium, despite the fact that zoos and aquariums and other kinds of comparable ecotourism experiences, there's pretty good data that the public, by and large, exits those experiences quite cranked up to do good things. But in the absence of any reinforcing experiences, they don't do much. They don't know how, and they don't know where. So, that data is tantalizing, but I don't know what it means, to be honest, at the moment. I'm not sure what kinds of behaviors they were referring to.
I mean, we have in some of our studies, there was an exhibit that was about women's health. There seemed to be a change in the fact that women did a monthly breast exam as a result of that exhibit, and they actually attributed it. Actually, interestingly, because there was actually an interactive in that exhibit that was more of a physical one that showed you how to do it. And, that's an important piece.
Yeah. I mean, there was I was involved with an exhibit at the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum, 5 million visitors a year, big numbers, which was designed to tell the public about ecosystems. And at the end of that exhibit, we created, there was a little takeaway where if you're interested in doing something about the environment, here are some numbers that you can call. And I gave them a code, and the number, you know, a condition for having a conservation group be listed on there was that they would try and keep track of how many people called and said, and they would ask, you know, what caused you to call. Well, there was a significant jump in the first year of phone calls, many of which were attributed to this. But, you know, what percentage of those people, you know, of the 5 million people a year who visited actually made the phone call, I don't know. I'm going to guess it's pretty small. But on the other hand, those institutions, those conservation institutions, saw nearly a doubling in the number of phone calls they got to volunteer to be part of their effort. So, again, I think the good news is the data would suggest that museums generically can affect behavior change, but it's not 100% of the people 100% of the time. It's more like 15-20% of the people, although, once again, I was surprised by that data.
Steve Spear from the Australian National Botanic Gardens. There's a lot of research talking about motivation and learning in science centres and children's museums and art galleries. From a botanic gardens point of view or a public gardens point of view in America, you partly answered the question in the last question. I was interested in any research that looks at motivation to visit public gardens or botanic gardens and also that question about behaviour change after leaving the gardens.
Again, there have been a couple studies. In fact, there's been some research done by Jan Packer and Roy Ballantyne here in Australia on motivations for going to botanical gardens. This is one of those times where that recharger category turns out to be really high. So there are an awful lot of people going to botanical gardens just to get away because they're wonderful, peaceful, lovely places to sit. By and large, those are people, their goal in life is not to change their behavior, other than their behavior by being there is being changed. So they have a very different view of what behavior change is. They might say they've changed their behavior, but it's not necessarily what you had in mind.
Yeah. Actually, I have a student, believe it or not, back on the East Coast, University of Delaware, who's in the public horticulture program there. She's actually doing a national survey now looking at the youth piece and the kind of programming that botanic gardens are doing with youth. So it's a different, it's not the public visiting, but it's the kinds of ways that they're engaging youth in public gardens. So I'd be happy to share her name with you, and you could be on the lookout for that. She's in the midst of doing the study right now. So,
hi, my name's Helena. I'm from the National Portrait Gallery. I just wanted, I was curious, given that you mentioned there's no sense really in looking at audience segments along families and different ordered like that. I'm just curious, that line that you said about how we understand that families don't come to art galleries so often, and given that learning is implicit in all environments, I'm curious where that comment came from.
Well, once again, the caveat is disregard at least 70% of everything I say. You know, I'm prone to hyperbole. Families do obviously go to art galleries. I would say in general, you know, if you created a continuum and had the public rate these on family-friendly environments, art museums would fall somewhere lower on that continuum than do science centers and children's museums. So that's not to say that families don't go to art galleries. But they are generally not perceived as, you know, the first place you think of, unless you happen to be the kind of person. You know, if you're a hardcore art person, then of course this is a family place to go. But in terms of the broader public, that would not necessarily be the perception. Now, I know there are a lot of art museums that are working very hard to change those perceptions and have had various levels of success. Some have been successful, some have been less successful. I don't mean to cast aspersions.
Yeah, if he has time, he can probably insult everyone in this room, so, you know.
Just to know me is to love me, yes.
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Shireen. I'm in private practice as a change management consultant here in Canberra and an ex-Oregonian, so welcome. Oh. Yeah. I grew up in art galleries and art museums in the United States, and again, it's what you said before, your family values influence your behavior then as an adult, so I'm not going to be able to move away from that. I want to go back to the bot gardens, the gentleman who's talking about the botanical gardens. I'm doing some research at the moment, sort of based around a program that was running recently in London called Slow Down London, and so I just wanted to share that with the audience, yeah. And you guys know about it already, I'm sure, where they were looking at trying to get people to slow down their lifestyle and linking in art museums and botanical gardens as an option for people to go to visit. And, of course, my first question was, who's researching the impact of those visits?
Yeah.
So thanks for what you shared today. It's been really valuable.
Yeah, I think that notion of the recharger is going to be more and more, you know, there's such a hectic pace to life that people are, I think that's going to be an increasingly sought outcome of these places.
Sue Stockelmayer, the Australian National University. First of all, thank you both very much for a fascinating talk and insights into your projects, which, as usual, are challenging us and stimulating. But my question is for Lynn. Your project with the girls, you followed them up a long time afterwards. How hard was it to find them?
Well, actually, how hard is it finding them at this moment? Because we're in the middle of the study. And investigation two, we plan, you know, for about 6 months. And we are actually finding it it challenging in some ways to track down young women. We are using social media, though. We've created a Facebook. That's helped quite a bit. So we have a Facebook for the project. We some of the projects already have Facebooks. We're also, anyone who participates in the survey, we're saying, you know, if you have other, you know, friends that you've kept in touch with, please let them know. Now, the issue about that, of course, and this is why we've said all along that this is not the definitive study, is, you know, clearly there are going to be some sampling issues in terms of you know, who's responding. And we've also, because we, one of the other criteria for the five programs that we chose is that they actually had a database that would help us, but it's actually been the most challenging part of the study to date. So
I'm amazed you found any.
And, you know, as we're going to the next question, I'll come back to that, an asterisk that I gave at the very beginning. This is the very fine print warning label on the bottom, which basically says that, you know, I'm talking about these identities and I'm talking about five identities. Be forewarned, you know, the world is truly much more complex than that, that people often have multiple identities. Not everybody on any given day fits into those identities. But it is my hope, and certainly my current observation, that about 60 to 65% of people, 60 to 65% of the time, can be made sense of through this model. And if you do the math, and if you know your elementary statistics, that's about half the people, half the time, right? Which,
and some people have mixed profiles, yep, too. So,
but my point is that if we can even make reasonable predictions about half the visitors, we're way ahead of them where we were before, where we could make reasonable predictions about none of our visitors, or a very small percentage. But I don't want to make the impression that somehow the world is quite that cut and dried and that simple. That's not the case.
Oh, come on. I want to tick off the box.
I'd like to, but I can't.
Is that everyone invited?
Yes. Yeah.
There's a chance to interact with us.
There is one more chance.
Yeah.
In a lifetime.
This is a quick one as well. So, M. Blamey from Questacon. This is a question for Lynn about the organisation that did the dinosaur exhibit.
Yeah.
And apologies if you did actually mention this. I was obviously focused on processing something else if you did. But you said one of the questions you were asking is whether people recognised that the institution had changed its strategy.
Oh, yes.
And I just wondered whether what the result was, whether people had noticed.
I'm sorry. You know, I didn't. It was implicit, but I didn't make it explicit. Actually, they had noticed, and in particular, they commented about the fact that they loved the fact that there were things that they could do, the adults, and that they really felt that. Interestingly, that exhibit was different. I don't think that they had a sense that the whole institution was different. But thank you for reminding me that I didn't answer that question.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for coming, and especially thank you to John and Lynn for your really insightful presentations and your really generous answers to all of our questions. I'd like to thank the ACT branch of Museums Australia again, and they've asked me to mention that next Thursday they're hosting a talk by Diana Davis at the National Portrait Gallery, looking at the National Review of Visual Arts Education and its implications for cultural institutions. As Lynn mentioned, you're all now invited to afternoon tea down in the main hall, and that's being provided by the Museums Australia Evaluation and Visitor Research Special Interest Group.
I'm also the president of the EverSync, and I wanted to mention that we're hoping to start a discussion on the museum's 3.0 social networking site about today's presentation. So please hook on there and have a look and share your thoughts and insights from today. So could you join me once again in thanking Dr. John Falk and Dr. Lynn Deerking?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.